Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing Nigeria's kidnapping epidemic. I'm joined by Dr. Samuel Uyewole. Samuel is a postdoc research fellow at the African Center for the Study of the United States and Ocean Regions Program of the Department of Political Sciences, University of Pretoria in South Africa. He's also a lecturer at the Department of Political Science, Federal University, Oyè-Èkìtì, Nigeria. Samuel, it's a pleasure to have you join me today, and I look forward to our conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, brilliant. So in Nigeria, let me go as far back as the beginning of the Fourth Republic, which is in 1999, when Nigeria returned to democratic government after 16 years of military rule. Nigeria has been experiencing kidnapping. There's been to the point where we can say there's a kidnapping epidemic, which in recent times has kind of escalated. So can you first of all provide that historical context, and then what has led to the spike in kidnapping?
Okay, thank you very much for having me once again. And even to go back to the history or the antecedent, when we have to trace the origin of kidnapping in Nigeria, we have to go back to the pre-colonial era. It's not a recent development. Issue of kidnapping can be noticed in the colonial, pre-colonial and colonial record. During the pre-colonial era, we have different dimensions of kidnapping, and one of them is kidnapping for ritual. In some cases, in many communities during the pre-colonial era, foreigners or strangers in the community, whenever they have to do anything ritual, may declare coffee at night. And in most cases, strangers that are just passing by that community fall victims of this imposed or sanctioned kidnapping of people for ritual. So there are records of such cases during the pre-colonial era. Again, kidnapping within the context of conflict is another thing that is common during the colonial, pre-colonial era. And in many cases, these kidnapped victims are turned to slave, or some of them find themselves in the transatlantic slave trade that was destined for America. So these are some of the dimensions or different manifestation of kidnapping in the pre-colonial Nigeria. There are other dimensions of kidnapping. Kidnapping for ransom have different meaning then, whereby someone is kidnapped to pressurize the system or to pressurize one pre-colonial community or society or kingdom to do the binding of the kidnap or the abductors, which in most cases are always sanctioned by authority, community leaders, and so on, as a means of political bargaining in the pre-colonial era. So during the colonial era, there were significant efforts by the colonial power to stabilize the system mainly to impose their will by banning slave trade and abolishing or passing law against ritual killing and some other things that actually forced many of these activities to go underground. It's not that they are not present or they were not present in the colonial era, but they were underground. They were not that popular. Despite that, the cases that became so obvious and notable with some newspaper record that are available and some historical record of colonial documents that shows some extreme cases of ritual killing that are connected to kidnapping. So some of them are community-based and some of them are individuals that want to get rich early or with the former work, as we know it, the get-rich-quick syndrome that we now know in Nigeria. So some of these issues emerged during the colonial, became prominent during the colonial era, despite the fact that publicly it is considered to be non-existent. They were underground activities. And again, one thing that I missed during the pre-colonial era is that in most cases, ritual-related killing and kidnapping are always community activities. However, the emergence of this rivalry among many communities in the wake of colonialism and the issue of slave trade, transatlantic slave trade, actually created a new dimension of individualistic ritual killing and kidnapping, whereby some tough generals, individuals, business people, men and women, that want to become rich and powerful in the society, embarked on an individualistic ritual killing and kidnapping for personal, not community purposes. So these are some of the issue during colonial and pre-colonial and colonial era. In post-colonial period or era in Nigeria, issue of kidnapping has never been something of the Fourth Republic. There are records showing that kidnapping predated the Fourth Republic. Many Nigerians, especially in the Southwest, as a child, you are sensitized to the idea of bomo, those that kidnap children. And then this is a popular thing. Don't talk to stranger. If a stranger call you, these are ways that we socialize children in Nigeria, giving them, even prior to the Fourth Republic, during the military rule, all these are part of how we were raised in Nigeria. Don't talk to children. Don't talk to someone that you don't know when you are on your way to school. Don't collect sweets, because all this idea is that someone can give you sweet and the kid can disappear from licking sweet. And this shows that the idea of kidnapping is not new in Nigeria. It was only underground, underworld, and not that popular in the public space. But the rise of militancy in the Niger Delta actually changed the dynamics of kidnapping in Nigeria. It started with barricade. And kidnapping is different from hostage taking. And although they are very closely connected, and hostage taking can be in form of barricade or in form of kidnapping. Kidnapping requires taking someone from one location to another. While barricade, which is a form of hostage taking, can mean sealing someone off in a particular location. And the Niger Delta militancy started with barricade, whereby oil personnel, oil firms and their facility will be sealed off by the community. And in many cases, they will not allow personnel to leave the platform or for any intervention to enter the facility. So it started like that in the 90s. And then the government of Nigeria responded with policing and military responses against such activities. There are records like that that I've examined in some of my previous study. And in such cases, those that were involved were communities, mainly demanding for one thing or the other from the oil companies, either demanding for electricity, demanding for cleaning of their society that were polluted by the oil firm, demand for clean water, demand for educational, because you Niger Delta was a place whereby you have some few people that are connected to the oil company living large in the same community where there were so many poor people that don't even have any benefit to show for hosting the oil facility. And because of the failure of the state in delivering development and human development to this community, the nearest available place they can show their display their grievances for the failure of the state to account to provide human development as well as to address issue of environmental security concern of the community is then the oil company. And in many cases, the community will barricade all the youth, the women in protest as a form of protest, barricade the oil facility. But because of the high-handedness of the state response, especially the use of police and the brutality that some of these activities involved, and the deployment of troops in response to some of this demand and protest, it forced many of these youths to re-examine their strategy. That instead of barricading the facility, why don't you take one or two personnel from that facility? Take them off. So for them, even the state is responding, the state's forces have to search for where the personnel that has been kidnapped are located before they can take any action. And that's why the transition from barricading, which is a form of hostage taking, to kidnapping as a form of hostage taking that we now experience from early year 2000. And from there, it started with political demand. Most of the earliest record of kidnapping in Nigeria started with political demand. That government should do this. The oil company should do this. It was mainly to get consensus for community. Then criminal element entered the scene. So this is a business. Instead of demanding something for community, we can demand for ransom. So again, militant group in early year 2000 saw that as an opportunity to fund their campaign. If you kidnap someone and you are able to extract millions of naira, you can use it to buy more weapon to support campaign against the government and the OFM and make more demand. So it became, in early year 2000, it became an object of ransoming for to advance the campaigning and the capability of militant groups for their campaign against the state, as well as for criminal groups that want to get quick money or to transform from, I mean, to get their own share. Some of them believe they are getting their own share of the oil profit by attacking the facility, kidnap one or two people or more, and then disappear with this personnel. Then it graduated from attack against a platform and personnel to attack against security agency and kidnapping of security agency to communicate, mainly to communicate against to communicate with the state that the state cannot do anything to many of these militants. It's for communication at a point in time, especially when it involves the security agency. Many occasions, there are records of kidnapping of state forces, police, military, and then some of them ended up being killed by militants. So, and then so many other dimensions follow up. Then more criminal group notice this as an opportunity to make money. Some young guys just come up. When you look at the age bracket of most of the arrested and suspect during between that 2006 to, I mean, from 2009 especially down to around 2015, 2016. In the Niger Delta, see a number of them are involved in either political violence or armed robbery. So people, in many cases, will just be stopped on the road, kidnapped, if they are important person that can pay enough ransom, and then they disappear. So many groups that were not considered as legitimate militant group by the community started springing up, some without name. Then the idea of unknown gunmen started becoming popular in Nigeria. Then these dynamics also entered the sea. Although Nigeria has a terrible record for piracy and armed robbery against ship from early 70s and 80s, based on my record, the dimension, the transformation of Niger Delta militancy into a maritime armed group also raised the threat of piracy in the Gulf of Guinea. And there were many cases of kidnapping of seafarers and for ransom in Nigerian territorial water and the Gulf of Guinea. I remember one of such cases actually attracted international attention and compelled me to do my master's research on piracy in the Gulf of Guinea. So so this particular incident continued and extended to the sea beyond Nigeria. And that's what in one of, in our book, there's a chapter that addressed the internationalization of kidnapping in Nigeria, whereby Nigerians, armed group, were involved in internationalizing kidnapping across the Gulf of Guinea. There are so many cases of Nigerian pirate group involvement in the kidnapping of seafarers in as far as in distant location like Cote d'Ivoire and far deep into the Gulf of Guinea. Now the trend moved from Niger Delta militancy to criminal group, and that criminal group spread across the country. And don't forget that kidnapping for ritual has been in existence even before colonialism. So although it was not that popular in the public space, we hardly discuss it in the media as a political agenda, but it has always been there. It's only the victims that knows what is happening to them, and communities are aware of all this. So, but it has never been considered as a major political subject or security subject in Nigeria. That kidnapping for ritual, because in most cases it involves politicians, business people, top business people in communities, and local politicians, that many community members know what is happening, but they cannot say anything. So why, that's why that particular subject or dimension of kidnapping has been relatively out of public space or discourse for many years or for decades. So now the rise of Boko Haram shifted the discourse again from militancy to terrorism and insurgency. And then Boko Haram used that strategy significantly to negotiate with the state, or what we call bargaining, communication and bargaining. And that was obvious in the case of the Chibok girls. The first record of, based on my record, the first incident of kidnapping by Boko Haram dated back to 2012, 2011. When the German Italian system were kidnapped in Kano or so. Then seven other expatriates were kidnapped. Then they expanded to Cameroon. They made a lot of money from Cameroon. $600 million was paid earlier. And then they got another maybe 2.3 million euro from Cameroonian government. So then they saw it as a major means of making money. Then they started kidnapping people in Nigeria, business people, and then people started paying secretly without telling anyone in the public space. Again, it expanded to issue of an ideological affair too, in the case of Boko Haram, because kidnapping of Chibogues and Dapchiges were linked to their campaign against women or female child education. So, and it was also linked to their campaign against Western education and Western values generally. So it has an ideological dimension. It has the financial dimension, which is linked to the campaign, to supporting their campaign. And so many other dimensions came into play at the peak of Boko Haram crisis. And as we all know that Boko Haram had different versions, the Al-Qaeda version, the Islamic State version, all of them were involved in this trends of kidnapping. Why the Islamic State version used this as a means to expand their rank and file, expand their structure and their human resources. In that case, many of the hostages were used to clean their camp, to support their fighters. Some of them turned out to be sex slaves and then married off to their commandant and so on. So some of them were used as spy on the military. And many, the usage move from strategic to tactical use of hostages in the war against Boko Haram. Then the bandits came up with their own dimension. Bandits were involved in kidnapping people on the street, on the road, from their house, and so on. So we have different dimensions of kidnapping in Nigeria, and that dimension, we have to pay attention to that dimension while contemplating or discussing the history of the whole subject matter.
Well, Samuel, you've provided a very comprehensive trajectory, the history and the development, of kidnapping. This is quite rich, and you've laid bare most of the actors involved, from armed groups to from pre-colonial, from the community to individuals to even politicians, to businessmen, to them. You've shown how these dynamics are a bit different. Now, what I want to look at, the next question would be. No, I think it's two questions. So from what you've said, it looks like kidnapping is a culture. It's part of a cultural thing. If you look at it, if you could trace it back to the pre-colonial up until now, it seems that it's a culture, it's part of the culture. Would you say it's part of the culture of the Nigerian scene, irrespective of the different tribes or different and groups? And having said that as well, I also wanted you to also talk a bit more about the distinction between the past and now. Whereas in the past, when you're tracing the pre-colonial, even coming back to the Niger Delta, I think in recent times, what we're seeing with the bandits and with Boko Haram, could you talk about the mass kidnapping? Would you classify that as a distinction? Because that seems to be a case where, would that be a distinction, and where do we see that going in terms of it's for the trajectory? Where do we see that going? And then lastly, because this is interlinked, and I see that you're providing it, so that's why I'm adding this question. The other one will be, are these actors distinct? Are they operating distinctively? Because you've seen a case where Boko Haram might be cooperating with the bandits or the band. Are they acting independently, or are they collaborating? Because we've all seen where Asare Dokubo, the Niger Delta, could have been, involved with the Boko Haram, maybe supplying of arms or whatever. So are they acting independently, or is there like some sort of collaboration or cooperation or competition, if you want to say?
Okay, thank you so much for that question. I think to start with, the issue of culture, I would not like to refer to address kidnapping as a culture of Nigeria. It is not a culture of the country, but it is a subculture. Every society have acceptable culture and those culture that are not too acceptable. So, but crime is a subculture. And you can find criminal element and indication of crime in every society. So crime is always a subculture in most society of the world. So it's not limited to Nigeria, but it's not a culture of the country, but it's a subculture that does not have that acceptability and legitimacy in the society. But why we talk about legitimacy, again, we have to be very careful, because there's certain tolerance for the crime. Because without certain tolerance, it will be easier for the state and the society to address it. But it has become something we live with. And the discourse have not been securitized. I mean, the subject has not been securitized enough to address it. So it's a subculture, not a general culture. It is not, there's no victim or relative of a victim that we consider kidnapping as a culture of the country. But it's a subculture that has developed over the years due to the failure of the state in providing human development and welfare. Because most of the youths that turn up for this crime could have been prevented from embracing this path if the state and the society actually provide better welfare and development context for many in the country. Because you have a number of graduates for 5-10 years without job, and you have those that are working that are underemployed due to their salary. So, and this is a major concern when an adult with 2 to 3 kids, 5-6 kids, is earning less than 20,000 or 30,000 in the month. The minimum wage is there, but how many people make up to this minimum wage outside the formal sector? So that's not a justification for crime, but it is a temptation for crime that encourage people. I've read stories, interviews of suspects that were arrested by police, by the military, on why they joined some of this criminal group. And when you look at the stories, some of them have, after graduation or after the reaching certain stage, some of them work with friends that just encourage them that if you try, you join us with this, you can make this amount of money. And for someone that is an idle hand, is a devil's workshop. So we have not tapped into human development. We as a country, we have underplayed the importance of human capital development and exhaustive use of our human resources. The greatest resources we have in Nigeria is the human factor. And that's the resources that we have underutilized most. We have strategy to exploit natural resources, gas, petroleum, gold, but to use to optimally use our human resources, we don't have that concrete strategy to use human resources. And that's why I consider it as a subculture, not a full culture or a general culture of the country, of the society.
So, since you're touching on this, sorry to cut you before you continue. Let me touch on that. So there are two things that is coming up from that. Now, again, we've seen stories as well where state securities have been found complicit in some of these kidnapping cases. So I'm just looking at when you say, you know, the tolerance, this kind of tolerance in the states. Could that also be one factor where even in the Niger Delta, we've seen where the military or the whatever involved in some of this, some of these things, you know, in terms of like the oil bunkering, some of these kidnapping things, we've seen where, you know, state security police armies or military have been involved in it. And also, again, following up on that, I've also, in my thinking, in my own analysis, I've looked at, it could also be a case of redistribution of wealth. So I'm looking at the bandits, where you could see where the state is negotiating with these bandits. In terms, I could think of the Sheikh, who I've met and I've interviewed as well, Ahmad Gumi, where maybe become like the middle man in terms of, you know, negotiator, and then the ransomware state is advocating for amnesty for these people or something. Could the state be complicit in that sense? That's number one. Number two is, since you've talked about some of the drivers of the push factors, you talk about poverty, you talk about absence of governance, which is quite a strong factor. But could you also put greed in there? So if you look at the culture, which I come back to the culture, which I think you might agree with this, that there's a culture of the get rich syndrome in Nigeria is a culture whereby you look at the politicians that are rent seeking. You were talking about the natural resources where extracting resources and rent, you know, is more attractive than, you know, help human resources. So they extract rent and then they become a politician, become so rich, and the youth see this and want to get rich quickly. Do you think there's a link in all this? Since everybody there's this greed also plays in all the need to get rich fast rather than also poverty?
Yeah, all those factors are relevant when analyzing the issue of kidnapping in Nigeria and the general crime ecosystem in Nigeria. Greed is very central to that. And just like I mentioned earlier, the society has become tolerant to people getting rich without explanation. The rich ones without any means of livelihood that is visible to the community are considered as are given chieftaincy title. Some of them, they are the headers in churches. And in all the religions, I don't want to single out any now, both in Christendom, in Muslim dominated society, even among traditional rulers, traditional worshippers, you see priority is given to those that are rich and powerful. And as a result of that, the society don't ask question, how do you make your money again? They are just concerned about you making the money. And that also influences civil servants, public servants generally that are involved in corruptions and other corrupt practices. And for the military that you mentioned, it's also part of it. And because the state has failed in that human capital development and in maximum utilization of human resources in Nigeria, the state has failed in that in doing that. Because you don't expect, if you look at the structure of the Nigerian military and the Nigerian police, you see that it's bottom heavy. So what's the salary of an average police officer? What's the salary of an average military personnel? You are paying a military personnel that you are harming with gun. You are paying them 100,000, 200,000. It's only recently that many of them are getting up to that. Before the recent minor increments, some of these security personnel are paid around 60 to 100,000. Because majority of them are recruits. And then you are harming them. I use this analogy in one of our discussion. You have a police officer, for instance, that has his family in Lagos or Ibadan, and is transferred to Kano. He maintained family in Ibadan. He has to maintain himself in Kano. He need accommodation in two different places. Then you are paying that person 100,000 in a month. You are aware, we all know the cost of transportation now in Nigeria. And then you expect that person, I know it has not a justification, but is it? It provides basis for temptation. The first thing is for you to take care of your citizen, then leave the rest for the security personnel to handle. But the security personnel themselves are not well motivated. And that's not limited to security agencies, it's across board. Why some people are stealing billions? Not millions, billions. I'm sure many people are following the recent
Emefiele.
by budgeting, about Nigerian budget padding, up to the tune of 1.something trillion naira. So if that can be happening in one side, and some people, the only thing they get as their take home is 60,000 or 70,000, and after that, maybe you get lesser, and deduction of pension and the rest of them, and you have to go to work every day. So that has encouraged many people to dip their hand into what they should not, or what they are not willing to do. And again, we have the culture of preaching, both in Christian, Muslim, and traditional, this miracle that you will find money that you did not work for. So it has become a subculture. And we would not like to consider it as a culture. So we have this culture of get quick rich, and the subculture is crime. Because after praying either as a Christian or Muslim for years and you think it's not working fast, many people turn up to help God. They believe they are helping God. Even those that are involved in terrorism, insurgency, kidnapping, armed robbery are still praying. Some of them pray before their operation. And that's why in most meetings in Nigeria, we start with prayer, we end with prayer, we light throughout the meeting.
You know, I was talking about, you know, I know you provided a comprehensive insight into the dynamics and, you know, trajectory of that. But again, I want to touch on how, I did mention mass. I know I did ask follow-up question, the mass kidnapping. And also, again, another dynamics is also we're seeing the use of technology. Can you comment on that in terms of, like, because again, over the years in the Fourth Republic, we've seen where it should have been easy to get, because you see where there's demand for ransom, and then, you know, the government or the security should have been sophisticated enough to track some of this payment or some of these calls, because there are calls made to this victim's family. So how are these kidnappers been, how are they able to evade all of this? So from that end, how are they able to use technology to evade? From the security agencies, why are they not able to deploy, you know, new forms of technology to be able to track these kidnappers?
Okay. I think there are so many factors that comes to play here. Now, crime in Nigeria has become so massive and widespread that the security agencies have to prioritize some above the other. The daily kidnapping that happened in Nigeria, the security agency don't have sufficient resources, both human and material resources, to respond to them. Because the crime cases, if you look at the statistics, you'll be scared. Both armed robbery, kidnapping, and many others. So how many police officers do we have in Nigeria? The population of the country is currently around 230 million people. Then we have less than maybe
about 600, but I think I did my research. Maybe about
around 300 to 600 police personnel, many of them guarding major facilities and politicians, while few of them are left in police station across the country. Then we have civil defense. We have the military that are battling with Boko Haram and Niger Delta, security concern, protection of maritime domain, and some many other things. So the threat is so massive in the broader scale. Now, talking about the mass kidnapping is made possible in Nigeria because of the failure of the state in other sector or in other area. Then, in most cases, when there's mass kidnapping, you can kidnap 300 people and take them to your house. It's not possible. You have to search for a forest to keep some of these people. And what happened to the forest that we have in Nigeria? Forest reserves are not well guided. It's the responsibility of some people. We have Ministry of Forestry or Department of Forestry. What are they doing? It's the duty, not the duty of the security forces. It's the duty of the Department of Forestry to manage forest across the country. But some of these forest reserves are not well managed. That's one problem. Again, we talk about technology. There are so many technology that can be deployed. But at both sides, both the criminal element and the state security forces now rely on certain technology to support their activities. For instance, many people fall victim of kidnapping through social media.
Mm-hmm.
Because they post their net worth on social media. Then they can put tracker on them. Okay, this man should be able to raise 1 million.
Yeah.
So the kidnappers, the terrorists, all of them are using digitalization now. They are using technology. Again, this off-shelf drone is also helping. Many of these terrorist group bandits have access to drone. All these small drone that are used for production and video recording. Some of them are used to monitor their targets and then before they strike. So they use it for surveillance, for intelligence gathering as a terrorist group and kidnappers. But beyond that, the state security forces are also using some of this technology. Nigerians have a number of satellites that we use for communication as well as Earth observation satellite. And the Nigerian military also orbited a satellite recently, I think last 2023 or so. So we have a military satellite, we have civilian satellite that are also supporting military activities and security agency. Nigeria have DSA, Defense Space Administration. We have so many other agency or unit of Nigerian security police unit that deal with this high tech and have access to drone, but not all. If you visit some police station, you can't see any laptop. There's no Wi-Fi. So, and these are the first point of contact. If there's any kidnapping anywhere, the nearest place you go to is the common police station that are nowhere equipped, not the state headquarters or the command center that is mostly disconnected from some of this incident, location of this incident. Because you hardly see massive kidnapping in the city unless unless by boarding a wrong transportation or this one-way transport.
One chance
transport. But massive kidnapping in schools, as we have witnessed with Bandit and Boko Haram, Dapchi Gaz and the rest of them, only happen in smaller community. Some of them some of them don't have access to some of this high tech that we are talking about that is available in Abuja and some of these major cities for the headquarters. And that talks about the decentralization of this technology for some of our police and military personnel. How much some of this technology are decentralized? Let me hear you.
Speaking about the urban rural kind of like dimension, and we've seen in how this issue of kidnapping and how it's been associated with a particular group, like maybe let's say the bandits, and it's been associated with the Fulanis, and the tension is brought with the communities. So you see where communities in different tribes, you know, like in everything in Nigeria, sometimes these things are drawn along fault lines, ethnic fault lines, religious fault lines. So you see where, let's say you come to the Southwest, for instance, you see the Amotekun, where you're setting a community vigilante group to deal with these issues, or you come to the East or come to all of this stuff. Before I come to the last question, how do you see this kind of community vigilante local response and the drive for community policing? I think this ties into the last question I was going to ask. So maybe I'll just ask and say, moving forward, what should be the approach to tackle this epidemic? So let's just round it off with that. So,
I think for Nigeria to counter kidnapping and some of the crises, other criminal and security concerns across the country, I think there's a need for the country to prioritize, to restructure its security and political system, starting with decentralization of the security agency. For instance, now in the political realm, local government has been relegated to nothing. And there are responsibility that local government is supposed to take in this security arrangement. The state government is too disconnected from some community. Likewise, the federal government. I don't know how federal government will know what is happening in a village in Cross River State. I know there is police station close by, but the issue is that there are certain decisions that are political.
Hmm.
So there's a need to revive the local government to perform its function. I'm aware there is a particular security meeting that's supposed to be that local government coordinate that involve different security agency within that local government, the traditional rulers and other stakeholders. That unit, that particular meeting has been disempowered by years of neglect on local government and intentional effort by the state government to steal the money of the local government. So in most cases, that meeting is not is mostly not functioning or not performing the right duty that they are supposed to perform. So there's a need for Nigeria to decentralize security arrangements. If possible, there's a need for Nigeria should prioritize having state police that is well regulated. Again, in most cases, the security, private security, should also be explored in the country. And possibly that will reduce the incentive for complicity of the security agency in some of this crime. Because someone can retire from the service of the state and join a private security firm or establish his own private security firm and discourage this attention of thinking what will happen after my retirement, what will happen after this. So we can explore that issue of private security arrangement as well. And politically, the state government needs to wake up to its responsibility, especially in managing urban planning. So many uncompleted buildings have become safe haven for criminal groups. The same thing with forest, either reserve forest or unreserved forest. Some of these forests have become hiding place for criminal elements. So the state government needs to be active in this context. Local vigilantes have to be empowered and arrangement, we have to reassess how they can be used for better security arrangement in the society. Not just informal group that does not follow any rules, or just community coming together to make their own rules, and that may end up as a jungle justice. And you mentioned the issue of Fulani people. I think it is better not to point fingers in time of crime. These are Nigerians, and whichever ethnic group they are coming from, they are involved in crime and should face the penalty. There are cases whereby assumption has been made that it is this ethnic group that is involved, and at the end of the day, after arrest, you discover that these people are involved, also involved. I mean, some of the suspects also are local community members. And in many cases, you see complicit of some traditional rulers, of some local politicians, and some senior politicians up there as well that are involved because they use some of this talk that turn out to be kidnappers or other involved in other criminal activities during election. So after election, they abandon them. Those guys fend for themselves by returning back to the street to make their money until the next election that they are needed. So the whole situation is complicated. We need to reassess our political structure and political values. And again, rearrange our security sector. And again, we need to prioritize funding of our security agency, better funding in terms of human capital first. Because you can be paying, I don't believe you can be paying someone 70,000 per month and you expect that person to defend with all his best, to defend the society, with all its best, with the kind of inflation record that we have in Nigeria now. So we need to reassess our security strategy in terms of funding the security agency. Mm. And again, all the security vote that most of these state governments receive, what are they doing with it? So it's time we start to ask questions, not to the federal government alone, to the state government and to the local government. Yes, they need to be more transparent. We should have record, published record of how much state government are getting in security vote so that people can assess what they are doing. With that security vote, some state government will buy just 2 vans or 10 vans for police for 4 years. They believe they have achieved something in terms of security, and they are receiving which amount of money? Mm. I think the last time any record around that was published, the least state in Nigeria was earning, that was more than 10 years ago, the least state in Nigeria was earning about 1 billion naira in security vote then. Mm. I don't know how much they are getting now. But there's a need for transparency and accountability in the security sector. You can't be sending some people to risk their life in, to face criminal group that are fully armed just because we are paying them 80,000. Why is some people are stealing billions? I think there's a need to revise our value as a society and as a country. Thank you.
Wow. Yeah, thank you very much, Samuel. I really, really appreciate your very, very rich insight. And I agree with you in everything you said. And hopefully those that need to listen will also listen to this and do the needful. But anyways, thank you very much. And I really, really appreciate it. Really appreciate, man, my brother. It's
my pleasure.
It's good. Thank you. I'll be in touch shortly. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Have a great day and enjoy yourself. Yeah.
And you too.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. And as usual, join me to thank our guest, Dr. Samuel Oyewole, for his very rich and deep insight into the kidnapping epidemic in Nigeria. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you next week.